Welcome, welcome from Alpha, to Omega.
Hello, and welcome to the 71st episode of From Alpha to Omega. Today is Friday, the 5th of August, and I'm your host, Tom O'Brien. I'm delighted to welcome back Ugo Bardi to the show. Ugo is Professor of Physical Chemistry at the University of Florence and the man behind the Cassandra's Legacy blog, where he writes about resource depletion, climate change, and renewable energy, amongst other things. We discuss the recent drop in global CO2 emissions and what it means for our global economic system, the hopes for a soft landing post-peak oil and peak coal, solar panels as our great saviour, and his thoughts on the likelihood of global demographic decline. But before we get into all that, I have a few people to thank. First off, all the monthly subscribers. Your money sits warmly in my pockets. Thanks must also go to the new YouTube subscribers. Ciao Cesar, Angus Prangus, Zombie Nation, Martin LA, Citizen Keynes, JoeGat.net, The T Cash Money, The Memes of Production, and Terrible Tomada. Muchas gracias. And of course, I also must thank Zaki, Poppered Pill, and Iluyu Papi for their lovely reviews over on iTunes. If you like the show, please like, subscribe, share, leave a review on iTunes and all that jazz, as it really helps spread the word about the show. You can also check out the Facebook group and the Twitter page. Now to the interview. Recently, there's been a peak in CO2 emissions globally. What does this mean?
That's a very interesting development. We have to be careful with that because there have been other peaks in the past, so it is not necessarily a long-term trend, but it may very well be because it fits with what has been found recently, which is very impressive, the fact that coal production in China has peaked, apparently, in 2014. Now, this is a real big development. It's impressive because the conventional thought in economics and most scenarios which were taking into account by the IPCC or various people dealing with climate change assumed that in order to curb coal consumption, you had to be proactive, to do something to prevent countries like China from using coal, from keep producing coal. And instead, in 2014, without any agreement, without any forcing, without any legislation, without any reason for doing that, China peaked, and now it is going down. Again, with some caution, because this may not be a long-term trend, but I think it is, because on the side of the peak movement, let's call it like that, people like myself, like others who have been studying this kind of subject, there was this idea that China should have peaked not later than 2020. And that it peaked in 2014 is not surprising for a certain fraction of the people who deal with this kind of thing. So if China peaked, then it is perfectly possible that other major producers, including India, would peak too. And that would lead to a reduction, a peak in CO2 emissions, because this is clearly what there is a consequentiality, there is a consequence in these things. If we reduce the consumption, the production, and the burning of coal, then we expect emissions to go down.
What's causing this peak? Is it natural factors or is it socioeconomic factors?
It is always a socioeconomical factor. Everything that happens is due to socioeconomical factors, because people, the companies, consumers, agents, governments, whatever you have, they don't see the natural factor. They only see economic and sometimes social factors. So whatever happens in the production of fossil fuels is the result of socio-economic factors. And this has not been understood by everybody because there is a current of opinion around that say, oh, peak oil is the result of not having any more oil to extract, which is not true. Peak oil is not related to running out of anything. It is related to the fact that it is not convenient anymore to extract oil or coal, gas, whatever, at the same rate as it used to be done before. So that's what's happening to Chinese coal, given the economic and social conditions of the present day China, which include also the government understanding that the pollution in China is so high that they cannot afford that anymore. It's an economic damage, which is immense in terms of the health of the citizens. So they're not stupid, they understand this. And they change things, they do things in such a way to reduce this tremendous economic cost, which is not about climate change. Climate change is a gigantic cost, much larger, but on a longer time scale. So the Chinese government is doing this to avoid killing their own citizens. I mean, governments are not benevolent organizations normally, but they don't like that the citizens die, because citizens are those people who pay taxes. And taxes is what governments live on. So they don't normally like to kill their own people. So what's happening is simply that a series of events are making coal extraction less convenient from an economic viewpoint. And then you have the peak. And this is the definition of the peak. The peak has always been a socioeconomic factor, the result, better said, of socioeconomic factors, which are combined several natural factors, which include depletion, but it is not the only one. There is depletion, there is pollution, there is damage to the various elements of the ecosystem. There are competitors to coal, which are starting to bite into the profitability of coal, like renewable energy. So we are seeing an extremely positive trend, in a sense, which may very well lead to a reduction in emissions, which is occurring without the IPCC, the COP21, the governments doing anything serious about that.
Did the quality of the coal that China were able to extract diminish at all? Is that playing a factor?
Probably, yes, but I don't think it was a major factor, because at the present time, what we have been doing, not just in China, but in Germany and everywhere, is using this so-called soft coal, which is very abundant, and its quality is going down slowly. So it is a factor. Eventually, we will run out even of this kind of coal, but not so immediate as we are seeing now. There are a series of factors which are all converging into making coal extraction less profitable.
So with Chinese coal, what percentage of their energy consumption is coal?
It's a high percentage. China has been said to have built its industrial revolution, its present prosperity. The fact that double-digit growth in the GDP is all due to the fact that they had all this coal that was cheap, reasonably cheap, and so they built up their industry on that cheap electric power, which is okay. At the start, it was nice, but then, as I said, I mean, the situation in China, as far as I know, is becoming really unsustainable, because really too much pollution due to coal emissions, and there is this good thing that they are building up a renewable industry that is competing with coal. So things change.
What impact does this reduction mean, do you think, for global CO2 figures?
In my opinion, what we are going to see is an irreversible reduction in emissions. We are going to see that clearly in the next few years, because the same factors which affect coal extraction in China are affecting coal extraction everywhere, but not just coal, all kinds of fossil fuels are becoming expensive. They suffer from the competition of renewable energy. They produce a pollution which is not acceptable anymore unless governments want really to see their citizens die, and they don't want normally that. And so there is a convergence of options which go towards a reduction in the production and the consumption of fossil fuels. That some people call this peak demand, which is probably correct, but it is not just that. It's a series of factors. It's a systemic change that we are seeing. My opinion, it is not correct to divide the world into supply and demand. There are no such factors that you can measure. But what you can say is that there is a system which operates the whole structured production, refining, distribution, use of fossil fuels. And this whole system is under heavy pressure to disappear, and eventually it will disappear. Now, this is a very good thing in several respects, because it means that what we thought was impossible to do, it is becoming possible, because we don't need international agreements. We don't need to go to take 10,000 people to Paris by plane in order to discuss how to reduce the consumption of fossil fuels, which is a little bit of a contradiction in terms, but we are seeing this trend, which is unavoidable and probably will be very rapid in the future. Again, it is a personal opinion of mine, but I've been studying how these complex systems tend to evolve. And what you find often is that they tend to evolve according to a behavior that I call the Seneca effect, or the Seneca cliff, which means that very often you see that a complex system switches to a different state by collapsing. That is, by declining very, very rapidly, much more rapidly than it grew. So we have seen, for instance, oil consumption growing at a certain speed over a century and a half. And for a certain period, the growth was constant at 7% yearly. It was fantastic. You would see oil going up every year, 7% more than before. Now, then it slowed down. Now, it is still growing very slowly, but still growing. Then at a certain point, it will stop growing and starting to go down. It is unavoidable. And that means that if some factors, some systemic factors start kicking in, that it will go down very rapidly, very, very rapidly. This is what I call a Seneca collapse. It's very interesting because it will be brutal and fast enough, perhaps, to reduce, perhaps, our worries about climate change. I mean, we have to say this with extreme caution, because be careful. Climate change is cumulative. So you add CO2 to the atmosphere and other gases, and this CO2 remains there for long times. It's a long story how much, which fraction remains for centuries, thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, but essentially it is cumulative. The more you emit, the more you find in the atmosphere. So global warming, which is the cause of climate change, which is the cause of ecosystem disruption, is cumulative. You add these things and you have them. So if you reduce emissions, you reduce the increase of these greenhouse gases. You don't reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. So it is not at all obvious that the fact that we reduce CO2 emissions will solve the climate change problem, but it could ease it a lot.
So do we have any statistics on whether Chinese energy output has increased or decreased during this period?
The Chinese output is still increasing because they are also building up other sources of energy. Coal is just one of them. So it's and the GDP of China has also been increasing. So the Chinese economy is still doing very well. I could compare the Chinese economy to the Italian economy, in which you have, in a certain sense, a more advanced economy in Italy, in the sense that we are more advanced towards collapse. So in Italy, there has been a brief period in which we reduced the consumption of fossil fuels while our GDP kept increasing. And everybody was saying, oh, we are so smart in Italy. You see, we can grow more with less. We can leave our economy still grows even without fossil fuels. But then, a few years later, what we saw is that the Italian GDP started going down too, because essentially the economy is something made using energy. It's an illusion, in my opinion, to think that you can grow your GDP without growing also the energy production and consumption, at least in the long run. You can have this decoupling for a few years. But again, GDP is a fleeting thing, is a measurement of something which is very aggregated. It's very, and we don't really know what is the GDP made of in different countries. It's very, very diverse. There are so many things that get into the GDP. The point, I think, much more to the point, it tells you what a country is doing, is how much energy that country consumes. If you look like at a country like Italy, and we reduced our consumption of crude oil of 35% over the past 10 years or so, that's a big change, and not a change for the good in terms of people wealth, in terms of material things. We see that the economy of Italy is contracting badly. The situation is not good. Although we are doing a good thing, we don't do it willingly, but we do this. We reduce the consumption of oil. We reduced it a lot because we could not afford to keep using it. So you see, there are so many things going on, but there is one thing that I would like to tell you, I think is fundamental from all this. There are two strategies we face in order to try to survive. I don't use the term solve problems, because some problems cannot be solved. The point in which we are now, it is a question of survival for the entity that we call civilization. And civilization is threatened by two main factors, by the depletion of natural resources, and the other is the destruction of the ecosystem, which produces the service that make civilization live. So we have to reduce emissions, we have to zero emission and fast. Otherwise, the whole Earth system goes to a state in which it is not obvious that we could survive as a civilization or even as human beings. So the point is, what do we do now? Do we focus on reducing emissions, or do we focus on keeping the energy services to civilization by pushing energy sources which are not fossil? So this is the basic question on which our future is pivoting. We make the right choice and we all die. We all survive. I'm sorry, we said it wrong. It may well be that we, even if we make the right choice, we all die. And that's what somebody said. In the long run, we are all dead, as you know. But the question is very fundamental. It's a question of strategy. It's being discussed now, because the focus right now is on reducing emissions, on using legislation in order to reduce fossil fuel consumption and hence reduce emissions. It is based on a business as usual view that if we don't do anything, the consumption of and the production of fossil fuels will continue going on from here to around 2100. But what we are seeing is that there are elements that indicate that the production and the consumption of fossil fuels could collapse in the next 10, 20 years. Could be. Now, if that happens, we don't need a carbon tax. We don't need emission target reduction. We don't need the intended national contribution that were discussed in Paris, because the system will by itself contract in such a way to reduce emissions faster than anyone would have thought possible. But if this is the case, then the trouble is a different one. Where do we get the energy that we need in order to survive?
So if we don't put in the regulation, it might just do it itself, but it could be a very chaotic kind of a collapse.
Not so chaotic. Not chaotic. Collapses are not chaotic. They have a logic, an internal logic. They happen because they are internally consistent.
No, fair enough. I kind of meant more politically chaotic.
Oh, that's already, it's not a problem. That's normal. When there is a crisis of resources, a crisis, people are getting poorer, and they're not happy about that, and so they vote for Mr. Trump, and hoping that they will get everything right again. I would not be Mr. Trump if I were elected, because honestly, I don't think he can make America great again. Just like we could try to in Italy, we would like to elect a Parmesan cheese president, and that would make Italy great again. But that's a joke. I'm sorry about that. Sorry about that. But you see, there is no more hope for Mr. Trump to fix America, to fix the American system, than for us to use Parmesan cheese to solve the problems of the Italian economy. No, the situation is. The turmoil now is unavoidable because we are going down in terms of the economic capability of the whole system. The flow of energy is being reduced into the system. Some regions are collapsing very rapidly, and then you are not surprised to see that collapse, the economic collapse of countries like Syria is accompanied by war. It is perfectly normal. We wait for a country to go down, sufficiently go down in its economic output, then people will decide at a certain point that what they cannot have by normal means, they can grab by using force. And that's war.
Since 2008, when the crisis first hit peak oil, there was a kind of a peak in interest, ironically, in peak oil. But that seems to have gone down in the last 7 or 8 years. Why do you think this is?
Well, the collapse is happening in bumps, of course. What we saw in 2008 was a first element of a movement which is starting now. Again, I think, my modest opinion, the economic factors, an indication of the state of health of a country, but much more than the economic factor, like the GDP, the financial health of the system, everything, is what a country produces and consumes. That's the metabolism of a country. It's a metabolic factor. So a country has an input of food, which is energy, and an output in terms of products, economic products, goods, in terms of its industry, its agriculture, and even the people it produces, because it has to produce a certain number of people to keep going, population. So these are factors essential for a country, like for a single human being. If you don't eat, then you may have some very good ideas in your head, but it is not possible for you for keeping going for a long time. So you see, for instance, in Europe, we had this big financial collapse in 2008, which corresponded immediately to a drop in the consumption of energy, and at the same time, a reduction in the economic output in terms of industrial production, for instance, of all European countries. Then most of these countries restarted, but they did not reach the levels previous crisis, like for Italy. Italy went up a little bit slowly, then it is going down again. And the economy, the Italian economic system is going down and collapsing, essentially. So I don't know how much we have to wait, because we enter in a civil war. I imagine that it would be reasonably easy to happen, because it takes nothing. A country prospers, like consider Syria as it was 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago. It was a quiet place with a solid government, solid enough that they could invade Lebanon, for instance, keep the army in Lebanon. Then they gave up. And then now they are in full disaster. Why? Because they used to have oil, a certain degree of oil production. Oil production peaked and collapsed. And now the whole glue that kept together the government, the people, the society, the economy, the industrial system disappeared. So the whole thing has unraveled. And one of the most spectacular consequences is war, but also immigration and widespread poverty and all the rest.
So where does photovoltaic solar panels fit into this decline?
They are our savior. The only possibility that we have at this point to avoid complete collapse is to push as much as possible renewable energy. Because if what I see happening is really happening, and the system is collapsing economically before the complete climate collapse, because that is a risk that we face too. The worst thing that it would happen together. If the climate collapse happens later, then we will see first the energy collapse. Society will collapse because it doesn't have enough energy to keep going. And at this point, we can try to supply society with this energy by in ways which do not imply instead going to a climate collapse. So by renewable energy, mainly photovoltaic, but also wind energy and other forms of energy that everybody knows are part of the park of technologies we have and we call renewable energy. Most of them are really renewable. A few are pretended renewable, but photovoltaics and wind are the most promising at present. Maybe something else or something new will come up in the future, but we already have technologies which can replace fossil fuels as a raw source of energy. That's what is the point. When we say replace fossil fuels, we don't mean that you can set up solar system and then keep everything else as it was. That's not possible. Things always change. Solar energy is a different kind of energy than it used to be fossil energy, and so the society will change deeply in ways that will allow it to adapt to this new source of energy, which is a pretty good source. It's a chance that we have for the future. It is a big chance, and we should take it by all means if we want to avoid a kind of collapse that would be very hard on us and also mainly to our children. We need to invest if we want to survive. I mean, we need to invest in order to solve the problems. I say we need to invest in order to survive.
So Ugo, on your website, you've had a couple of different articles talking about, say, the return on energy for these photovoltaic systems. There seems to be a bit of debate within the EROEI community, if you want to call it that. So where do you stand on this, or what are the issues involved here?
There is no problem, no issue. The only issue is survival. I'm sure that if we wanted to invest enough in photovoltaic energy, we can survive. If we kept discussing and we don't invest, civilization as we know it will disappear. Some people will probably survive anyway, but we need to stop useless discussions and to act on what's going on. And we need to understand that a lot of this discussion is created by a certain degree of resistance to change, which is ingrained in the human mind. People don't want to change, so they rationalize that change is not possible. But we need to change, and we need to change now, and we need to change with the technologies we have. We cannot wait for the miracle technology that could save us, because there is no such a technology. It is unlikely that it will happen. And generally speaking, you don't solve your financial problems by buying tickets for the state lottery. And so waiting for the miracle technology now is like trying to solve our problems by hoping to win at the state lottery. We are not going to survive in that way. So we need to start investing now, to invest a lot. That's the results of some calculations that we made with our co-workers. You see, photovoltaic energy is a good technology. Works. It has a good return. You spend some money to set it up, build a plant. It costs money. It costs energy. Then for 25 years, you get energy for free, which is very good. Excellent. You know, it's a return that no other technology gives to you, essentially, especially because you don't have pollution out of a photovoltaic plant. Zero pollution, zero needs for fuel, modest needs for maintenance. I know the person who set up one of the first photovoltaic plants in Italy some 30 years ago, and the plant still works. It's fantastic. So we have this technology. We can use it. It can do us a lot of good. because it gives us clean energy for free. Not bad, but we have to invest on it. All investments have a moment in which you have to pay money on the hope that you will get the money back in the future. And the problem is, how much do we have to invest in order to go through the transition which is in face of us, a transition which has two critical points. One is to avoid climate collapse. The other is to avoid the economic collapse. And it is possible. Our calculations indicate that it is feasible, but you have to invest much more than what we are investing now. Much more, at least a factor of 10 more. That's pretty possible. We're talking about a few percent of the world's GDP, and it's not impossible. The point, it's feasible. The point is that in order to invest this kind of money in a system which is contracting, you have to take it from other sectors of the economy. And that's a problem. So think about the military. The military are spending enough now that if we were to spend what the military are spending now, we would have no problems. We go through the transition in 20 years and we get rid of fossil fuels in 20 years. But you cannot go to say, you do it if you like, go tell to the military, ah, gentlemen, I'm sorry, you are all fired because all the money we're spending for you will go to build photovoltaic plants. It's not going to work, unfortunately. So you see what the problem is. Any sector is desperately trying to cling to the resources it has. And so it would need a degree of agreement that at present doesn't exist.
So one thing about renewable energies is that they take in a certain amount of energy and it's kind of capped. There's a certain amount of energy that comes from the sun every year, and similarly wind. And that in that kind of a system, we can't have essentially economic growth forever, that we need to somehow transition to a steady state economy. What would this mean for our lifestyles?
This is not a big problem. It's unavoidable. You probably know something that the economist Kenneth Boulder said a few decades ago. Anybody who thinks that growth can go on forever on a finite planet is either an idiot or an economist. So this sentence is very well known, independently of what we do. We use photovoltaic energy, we go back to Middle Ages, so we go back to Stone Age, we go extinct, or we keep growing using renewables, but modestly, because on this planet the amount of energy that comes down from the sun is limited, so eventually we have to slow down and adapt. That's unavoidable. The point is, at which level do we adapt to the limits of the planet? So it is perfectly possible to adapt at a Stone Age level, because our ancestors up to some 10,000 years ago, a little more, there were probably a few billion people on the Earth, and they were living in a situation that implied very little economic growth, because they were exploiting the available resources in ways that were probably reasonably sustainable. And then a relatively low level. I mean, it's perfectly possible that we could go back to that. Some people say that that's the destiny of humankind. It could be. Why not? Our ancestor did that. So who are we to think that we can do so much better than them? They have lived in that way for billions of years. We have been an industrial civilization for just a few centuries. So, I mean, are you sure that you can keep going like that? Or the other possibility is to go back to agriculture, which is also a long tradition. Our ancestors have been doing agriculture for 5,000-6,000 more years. And so, say, they are one of our agricultural ancestors. You think a Sumerian priest would look at us and say, what do you think you're doing, you guys? We have been doing this. You see, we are in the city in Sumer, in the plains of Mesopotamia, and we have been doing agriculture for 3,000 years, and it works. Why do you want to bother with this silly idea of fossil fuels and industrial plants? That's also possible. Or we could keep an industrial civilization if we have a source of abundant and clean energy, which can only come from renewable technologies that we have. So we could do that. I think we will do it eventually. But on the Earth, we need to find a sort of stable situation, because it's just not possible. There are limits to what you can do in terms of photovoltaic energy. Also, you cannot pave the whole planet with photovoltaic panels. There would be nothing left to eat anymore. So possibly we can use about 1%, a few percent of the area of the planet for photovoltaic plants, and that would give us a huge amount of energy, much larger than anything we are producing now. So that would be perfectly possible. And then again, we have to find some kind of stable state. I would like to remember, however, that in human history, the periods of rapid growth have always been the exception rather than the rule. Many civilizations were more or less stable, and they are being stable for hundreds or thousands of years. So I think we are going to some kind of similar situation. That we will, it's something that our descendants will see.
You also wrote some article on the way these post-peak models describe population decline. What did the normal models that have come from, say, limits to growth say, and what's your ideas of it?
That's possible, but extremely difficult. Demography is one of the most difficult fields of science. It is extremely difficult, because when you think of a model like the limits to growth, it is essentially a model based on thermodynamics. You deal with energy in ways the energy is exploited by the human industrial society, and there is some logic in the way. If you assume that people go for the highest profit, which is the basic assumption of all economic studies, then it works. It works very nicely, because people normally are reasonably rational. They do what they think are reasonable choices, and you can model that, and it works. If you assume that people are altruistic, then the models don't work anymore. And so that's good. But then when you go modeling population, you have choices that is hard to define as rational. Why do people have children? Do they make money out of children? Not so easy. And not obvious, not immediately at least. And so it's very difficult, very difficult. And the story is that the first limits to growth used as a guideline in order to create the model that described the whole world's economy, they used historical data. And they matched the reproductive rate of human beings with their income, finding what is very well known as the transition, the natality transition, which says that as people become rich, they tend to have less children, not more. And so they plugged in these results into the model, and they obtained a rather strange result that the economy would collapse, the world's economy would collapse around 2020, but population would keep growing up to 2040 and more, then to collapse, which is not so likely, my opinion. Actually, it's absurd, because if you look at what happens during economic collapses, you see that in places like the Soviet Union, for instance, you have an economic collapse in 1991, and the population started declining immediately, actually even before the collapse, the economic collapse. So if you look at the more recent results of the same model, they say they modified the model, because really, we don't know how people react to economic crisis in terms of natality. Do they want to have children? Do they want to have more children? Do they want to have less children? And so it is an unknown here we are facing. In my opinion, I think we are going to see something very close to what was seen with the collapse of the Soviet Union, but planet-wide. So we are going to see at the next big economic downturn, we are going to see an immediate decline of the world population. So the population will start declining immediately after the peak, I think. But then we're going to see that.
So you looked into the experience of Ireland post-famine in the 1840s, 1850s. What did that display?
A lot of things. The collapse of Ireland is so interesting, so full of lessons that we did not learn. It's incredible. And one thing, one is the thing that I just said, that if we go to see the data, you see that the Irish did not try to compensate for the famine having more children. There was a very big increase in mortality with the famine, but also a decrease in natality. So there is not this effect that people say there would be, that people try to compensate. People try to react to difficult times by having less children. Then there is a more general lesson from the Irish famine, which again, what caused it? Because it's impressive to see, to read how much it has been written on that. And we know everything about the famine. We know how many people who died, who survived, the production, the emigration, the supply that was tried to compensate the famine. And still, there is no agreement on what caused the famine, with a good fraction of the people working on that saying it was a genocide caused by the evil English who decide to exterminate their unruly Irish subjects. Which is not true, that didn't happen, but there is something in this idea. Essentially, the reason that led the Irish to collapse so badly in 1845 was a lack of resilience. The system was not resilient. And that's a fundamental point. In principle, Ireland could have nourished even more people than the about 8 million it was nourishing in 1844, before the famine. According to some calculations of the time, if the model of cultivation that was used in Ireland at that time, it was very simple. You would have a family, the family would rent a patch of land, cultivate potatoes, and with these potatoes survive. Essentially, they didn't need much more than that. And Ireland, theoretically, could have nourished perhaps 17 million people, but it collapsed already at 8 million people. In reality, it had collapsed even before. There had been earlier famines, less known, but just as bad, like in 1740, more or less. There was another famine, in relative terms, even larger than the Great Famine, that was the best known one. And at that time, there were only about 3.5 million Irish people in Ireland. So you see, it's not a question of population density. You can collapse with 3 million people. Ireland could collapse with 3 million people, just as it could collapse with 8 million people. So it is not a question of overpopulation. It is a question of resilience of the system. And the system was not resilient because Ireland was poor, in the sense that people just didn't have an economy worth calling an economy. There was little commerce, there were no industry, there were no railroads. There was a road network, but not very good. And why was Ireland so poor? Because the English had been exploiting Ireland as if it were a colony. And they had no interest to have Ireland developing economically. So if you are very poor and you rely on agriculture, then you are subject to famines because the system is not resilient. You have your patch of land sufficient to nourish your family. But eventually, there will be a bad year in which the patch will not produce enough. And then there are two possibilities. Either you have some money to buy food somewhere, or if you don't, you die. And that's what happened to Ireland. A non-monetarized economy is extremely vulnerable to famines, to this kind of disruption of the food supply. It's not a question of productivity. It's not a question of agriculture. It's a question of food supply, which is completely different. It's not just producing food. It's the capability to bring it to the place where it is needed. And this is done in our world with what we call the market. But if you don't have money, if you're very poor, you're shut off of the market and you cannot afford it to buy the food you need. And that's what happened to Ireland.
Also, an over-reliance on a single crop is a very risky strategy.
Exactly, because you cannot, it's nothing wrong in using one crop. If it fails, you have your savings in the bank and you buy food from somewhere else, if you can. And you know that there is a very interesting story that we haven't been having famines in the world during the past 30 years or even more, which is very good. It's unbelievably good. From the last major famines were in the 1970s, and now we are famine free so far. Why are we? It is the result of globalization. Globalization has created a worldwide market, which is monetarized and which has created the capability to distribute food everywhere, and also created the financial instruments which distribute, to create the market condition which allow poor people to get food, even if they cannot afford food. These are called the food relief agencies, which manage, I'm not sure how much, but probably a few tens of billions of dollars yearly. To buy food, the excess food produced in some regions of the world, and distribute it in the poorest regions of the world. This is a market mechanism. It is goodwill in great part, but it is also a market mechanism which is conceived to help farmers in rich countries, which is okay. I mean, initially, the idea of food relief agency was to fight communism. It was said very clearly, we have to fight communism, and we do that also feeding the people. It was a very good idea, I think. And now we have this situation in which, as long as we can keep the globalized transportation system by containers, then famine will remain a thing of the past, which is good. I think there are some good things to be said about globalization, I think. And this is one. But the question is, for how long?
It's interesting that I think, as far as I know, Ireland must be the only country that has a smaller population than it had in 1840. Is there any other country you can think?
That's a good question. You know, I had not been thinking about that. I think you are right. Most people, most cases, population has increased from the mid-19th century. So it's a good point. Ireland is a special case under many respects. But it should be looked over, because right now you caught me by surprise, and I cannot say. Some country which had a very hard, which was very hard hit in some condition, but we should be looking it over.
Anyway, Hugo, thanks very much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, I hope you liked it. I said a lot of controversial things, and I think a lot of people will run after me with pickaxes and forks for what I said, but I will be wearing a fake bird, so I'm not worried about that.
Very good. On this episode, you heard the theme tune, The Order of the Pharaonic Jesters, by Sun Ra and his orchestra, and you are now listening to White Isles with Loose Cannon. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me for the next episode of From Alpha to Omega. And remember, please like, subscribe, share, or leave a review. This is better than having to run to the side of the line. Keep the engine on, go, give a man.